listening to the Getting to the Heart of It with Sarah podcast. As the co-founder and CEO of Tarod Solutions, we support our first responders, Australian Defence Force veterans, and other emergency services personnel in their transition to post-service employment with purpose. People are the heart of our business, which is how Getting to the Heart of It was created. You'll have the honour of hearing firsthand stories from the ones who have or who are still serving our beautiful country. You can expect real and raw conversations with our heroes. So hop in, hold on for the ride while you ignite your own sense of purpose as you navigate your way through the ups and downs of life and seek insight through others' experiences. This is where we get to the heart of it. Gentlemen, welcome to the Getting to the Heart of It with Sarah. It is a pleasure to have you here. I have to admit, I'm a little bit excited to have you all on the show. It was one of my dear friends, Paul Milne, who directed me to read your book, The Resilient Shield. And I have to say, there are some nuggets of gold in here. And what you've written, I'm sure, will have some profound impacts on people. So I really wanted to get you on the show so we could dive in a little bit more. So joining us today, we have got Dr. Dan Pronk, Ben Pronk, and Tim Curtis, all former Australian SAS veterans. I believe that there's a book in all of us, but not all of us are willing to share their story, and you guys did this. So just before we dive into the book, I mentioned previously, you know, when we do go through some personal development work and we're working on ourselves, we're going through a bit of a journey, we learn a lot about ourselves. And I see that this book is, it's like you guys have been on, you have been on your own journey, and you've shared a lot of personal experiences in this book. And so I wonder whether, you know, there was more that you learned about yourself while you were writing this book. So, Ben, if I could hand this one over to you.
I think one of the big things that we all learned, and I don't know if it's a chicken and egg, whether we were thinking about this that drove us to sort of writing the book and going deeper on resilience or the other way around, but this idea of happiness and success. I sort of transitioned out of the military, you know, as we all had, and I think it was very clear at that stage, you know, it's a fairly hierarchical structure and I was sort of progressing up the ranks and all those sorts of things. That sort of linear progress seemed to me a proxy for success. But as I came out and started thinking more about, well, what's it all about? What does happiness actually mean? Is it just that next rank or that next sort of, you know, higher status or whatever it might be? It became pretty clear that it wasn't. And concurrently, you know, Dan was going through his own journey and we'd met back up with Tim and we're all sort of reflecting on how we could ultimately increase happiness. And I think these ideas of happiness, we start the book talking about, you know, what does that mean? It's very much linked with this concept of resilience. I mean, what are we trying to work towards? What are we trying to achieve with increased well-being, if not a greater sense of happiness? So for me, it was, you know, the thing I took away from the book was having a much deeper think about what success or happiness, and I use them almost interchangeably, means to me. And it became very clear that it wasn't just that next, you know, rung on the ladder or the higher paycheck or the sort of, you know, fancier job title, but it was more about doing things that had real meaning, being able to spend time with people I love. We've sort of created a job where we get to spend time with people we love. We get to do things that we think are meaningful. And those kind of experiential things, both on the family and the work front, very much sort of crystallized for me as something that I took away from the whole writing and studying process.
Oh, yeah, happiness. It's. I think it's a topic on its own, and it is something that I'd really like to talk about later on in the podcast. Yeah, that was a brilliant answer. Thank you so much. If we were able to dive in a little bit more into the six layers of resilience now. Us humans are so complex, and I love the way that you've kind of captured everything holistically in these six layers of the resilience shield. It's like taking that, it's a holistic approach to the core of our being and all of the aspects of our lives. So those six layers of resilience that you talk about, innate, mind, body, excuse me, social, professional, and adaption, I'd really like to touch on some of those. And as we do, there's a couple of things that I wanted to call out that really resonated with me, and maybe we can talk about those, but they were more related to the mind. Maybe I'll hand over to you, Tim, perhaps to just give a bit of an overview of those six layers of resilience.
The truth is we stole a lot of material and packaged it up in this book. I mean,
You don't say that, Tim.
The reality is it's important that the book wasn't just a reflection of our own opinion, but rather we're able to back this with evidence, grounded in research, in the literature, and also embrace some thousands of years old philosophy. So we recognise that being resilient wasn't about doing the yoga class, having a close group of friends, being good at your job. It was all of those things and more. And it logically fell down to these layers. The top layer, of course, is the innate layer. We all have some element of resilience. You're sitting right there with it now, Sarah. It's part nature, part nurture, genetics and epigenetics. Unfortunately, for us, it's not particularly modifiable. We can't go back and change your genetic makeup or rearrange the way that you were brought up, how you were brought up. There's a lot you can do for your kids, however. So the first truly modifiable layer is the mind layer, and that breaks down into a couple of parts. The first is mindset, which is your beliefs and your expectations, the view you take of things. And the second part is the importance of meditation and mindfulness practices. We like to say historically has just had a really bad PR campaign. Then we enter the body layer and we get no prizes for saying it's sleep, diet and exercise. However, when you're under stress load, they're often the first three things that go. You're willing to compromise sleep, diet and exercise.
Absolutely.
The social layer, the importance of those people who are in your social support networks and those people that you're there for as well. This is about not being alone. There's some fascinating evidence on being lonely and the physiological impacts of being lonely. And noting, of course, that loneliness is very different to solitude. You need solitude in order to have a strong mind layer, but you certainly don't want to be lonely. The professional layer, it's about leveling the bubble between competence and confidence. No one likes that person that's incredibly confident but not very competent. And sadly, those people that are incredibly competent but not very confident, that's not a very good equation either. No. So this recognises that if you suck at your job, it's likely to bring more stress to your life. So how do we improve our professional outlook, improve focus and attention? And then the layer you get for free is adaptation. It recognises that if you're broadly resilient in all those other categories, all of those other layers, adaptation is your ability to do things that you never thought were possible.
That was some great insights into those layers. In the mind call to action, you talk about finding a piece of writing that is motivating or that speaks to you. I loved this. And the reason I loved it is because there were some times in my life that were pretty tough. And the piece of writing that actually gave me a little bit more motivation, I guess, and inspiration was the Desiderata by Max Ehrman. It's such a powerful piece, isn't it? And just this, you are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. And so words can be so powerful. They can be so powerful for people. So yeah, I really loved that. So chapter two, this is something that I think many of us struggle with. You talk about making sense of our complex, unfair and beautiful world. I've often contemplated and at times struggled with the inequity of this world. You know, that's so important. But I love the always a little further. Always a little further. Who's best to talk about that one?
Yeah, I probably could. That, again, you know, Tim said we stole a lot of stuff. You definitely stole that.
Saying you stole it.
Well, it's all.
There could be a little.
It's in the bibliography notes. That, in fact, that's a double steal. That's the last time I mentioned the word steal. But that's a line from a piece of poetry called The Golden Journey to Samarkand, which is a wonderful poem by a guy called James Elroy Flecker, and it talks about a
a caravan in biblical times of traders heading off along the Silk Road to this place called Samarkand in modern day Uzbekistan. And the master of the caravan sort of walking down, and he's speaking to the spice traders and then the textile traders and the jewelry traders. And he comes across this sort of ragtag group at the front, and he asks them, "Who are ye in rags and rotten shoes, you dirty bearded, blocking up the way?" They respond, "We are the pilgrims, master, and we shall go always a little further." And this line was very much appropriated by the British SAS. It's that excerpt or that stanza from the poem is on their clock tower, which is very sacred sort of memorial in the center of their barracks, on which they list all the names of their fallen. And so it was this concept of just that incremental improvement, you know, when the chips are down, when it's raining, when it's muddy, when you've got 60 kilos on your back, it's not about this grand gesture. It's just that next foot in front of you, which I think is a wonderful way of looking at excellence in any field. And, you know, you spoke, Sarah, about the power of words. That for me personally has become something of a mantra that, you know, when things are tough, that next step, always just that little further, is, I think, something that's very tangible and motivating, and became a real touchstone for us as we were looking at this concept of improving your risk level.
It is. And you can use that every day, you know, like even just, I'm going to get up out of bed today. I'm going to have a shower today. I'm going to go for a walk, but always that little bit further. So earlier on, you were talking about, you touched on happiness, and this is interesting. And so you state in the book, there is no true happiness without struggle. So I would like to understand that a little bit more. Do we really have to go through the shit to get through, you know, to enjoy the good times in life? Yeah, it's interesting.
The answer is yes and no. That has been proven through a guy out of the US called Paul Bloom, who researched what makes people happy, seven neurochemicals associated with happiness. That's why we feel happy. That's why we get that warm and fuzzy feeling. And he recognized through his experiments that putting people through a struggle, once they overcame that adversity, the challenge, the problem, those neurochemicals fired hard and it made them feel happy. However, there's a second school of thought, which relates to this thing called synthetic happiness. It's a term coined by Dan Gilbert. Now, synthetic happiness sounds like it's fake, but synthetic happiness is as fake as nylon. You can't go and pick nylon off a nylon tree, but it's real. You can touch it. And Dan Gilbert's identified that there are plenty of things we do in our day that make us feel happy. That is, still fire one or more of those seven neurochemicals, but it doesn't require a whole lot of effort. For example, we've got a new puppy in our house. Playing with a puppy this morning brought me joy, made me feel happy, but there wasn't much struggle. Here's the kicker. Unfortunately, with synthetic happiness, if I think about the coffee I've just had and how that made me a little bit happy, and I do it tomorrow, it's not going to fire the neurochemistry. However, the struggle, something that's profound, something that's an obstacle I have worked to overcome and come through, if I close my eyes in 4 months' time, says Bloom's research, it will still fire the neurochemistry. So the concept here is, in order to be happy, do both. Identify what's your meaningful challenge, work to overcome that, and every day layer on your happiness with those things that bring you even a little bit of joy.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. I'm probably going a little bit backwards in the book, talking about life's not fair, but there was something that I found, a word actually I'd never heard of before, and that word it's on page 111, and the sentence is, the sooner you can let go of the idea that the world or anything in it somehow owes you anything, the better chance you'll give yourself of starting the journey towards true
eudaimonia.
Yes. And I had to look this one up. So flourishing, Aristotle described this as the highest good humans could strive for, towards a life well lived. And then you've got in here, when you wake up in the morning, tell yourself that people I deal with today will be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. They are like this because they can't tell good from evil. But I have seen the beauty of good and the ugliness of evil, and have recognized that the wrongdoer has a nature related to my own, not of the same blood or birth, but the same mind and possessing a share of the divine. And so none of them can hurt me. No one can implicate me in ugliness. And then you go, get active in your own rescue. Get active in your own rescue. And so, you know, there are some people out there that we come across that are not so nice, that are ugly. But I think, you know, these are so powerful, these words. And it's about, like, I love how you talk about, you know, it's important for us to get to our core, to understand who we are and be able to recognize that there's others out there that might throw stones sometimes. But I think, yeah, if we have that strong core, we can actually work through it. But this get active in your own rescue, Dan, do you want to talk to us about that one?
Well, yeah, once again, I won't use the stole, but we borrowed that from Aurelius. We can't claim that. Wish we could. Actually, those last two quotes that you mentioned were Marcus Aurelius quotes and very sage, you know, very ancient wisdom, but holds so true today. But the get active in your own rescue piece is very much about locus of control and which exists on a spectrum. It's a psychological construct, exists on a spectrum from external locus of control where you feel you're a victim of circumstance, you're along for the ride, you don't have any ability to influence the outcome of the situation, all the way to the positive end, the internal locus of control, where you feel you're in the driver's seat, where you feel you're the captain of the ship and your actions will influence the outcome of a situation. And that's where you want to be. But fundamental to getting there is a realistic idea of what you can and can't influence or control. And once again, very stoic sort of philosophies that have been elaborated on in modern psychology, but just pairing things back to focusing in on what you can control and influence. And so at the core of it, really, you control your thoughts, behaviors, attitudes, responses. It's a pretty small list of what you can control and can and should be held accountable for. Radiating out from that is a sphere of influence. And as the name suggests, these are situations or people you can have an influence on, but you can't ultimately be held accountable for the outcome. And then further out from there is this sphere of interest. It's things that are of interest to you, but you have no control or influence over. And so just identifying what you can and can't control and influence and trying to focus on being the best version of yourself. But my interpretation also of that Marcus Aurelius quote where he's talking about, you know, you're going to meet bad people throughout your day. And I sort of see that through that lens of gratitude as it is in opposition to vengeance or resentment and just what you choose to focus on in any given situation. There's always going to be negatives that you can focus in on, and that drives that vengeance or resentment and a stress response. Or you can choose to try and look for the positives in every situation and focus in on them. And that fuels that really positive gratitude type mindset that then drives more positive neurochemicals, that serotonin mood regulators. So, yeah, I think there's some fantastic stuff tied up in that ancient wisdom. But the get active in your own rescue is all about that locus of control and focusing on what you can do and doing that to the best of your ability.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. There was something that I was going to touch on then, but I can't remember.
I might just jump in.
Yeah, go ahead.
I always get up, Dan, for doing this and I'm just doing it myself. But one thing I've found is a really practical way of bringing that into your line is choosing to be kind. You know, when you get that thing, you know, you meet that surly, resentful, awful person that, you know, cuts you off in traffic. If you're able to choose, maybe they're rushing their child to hospital, you know, it doesn't matter if they are or aren't. They're probably just an asshole. But if you're able to choose, well, what if that was the case? It just instantly diffuses your anger. So instead of being indignant, instead of being, you know, raging against the machine, you know, sort of screaming into the wind about someone being inconsiderate, you know, you choose, okay, well, maybe there's something behind it, and it just evaporates. It's amazing how if you make that active choice to be kind in those sorts of situations, to Dan's point, you can dramatically change the biochemistry in terms of what's firing in your head, and you feel better, which is a positive, I think.
You're so right, and it actually reminds me of something my late mum used to say to me, and she would always say, always be kind to people because you never know what they're actually going through. So always be kind. Yeah. And that outlook, though, of, you know, thinking about the outset for the day and, you know, you may come across these ugly people is a little bit probably a left field to the way that I like to get up and think how I'm going to interact with people and what my day is going to look like. You know, that positive mindset of, no, I'm going to come across some great people today. It's going to, you know, I'm going to achieve great things today. So, yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it. But, you know, yeah, just being prepared for that is always good.
Almost a thing called the Stockdale paradox where, you know, you do want to have optimism. You do want to manifest and be positive, but you can't confuse the faith that you'll prevail in the end with the discipline to confront the brutal facts of your reality, however hard they may be. So, you know, you need to temper it with, you know, yeah, I am going to look for the good in people. I'm going to sort of notice that. But, yeah, I may meet those assholes as well, and I'm going to choose to be kind or not let that impact me or deal with it realistically.
Yeah. And it is so powerful. And I think so, you know, talking about the resilience shield and having that resilience shield around you. And then other people have said, you know, oh, we've got to build that elephant skin too. And I think we do. We do have to build that. So, Dan, you talked about stoicism. You're talking a little bit about that and becoming a stoic. This is interesting where you talk about in the book, never forget you're going to die. And a lot of people don't like to talk about death. I think it's something that we should talk about it. It's something that happens in life. And I know that I've survived through his end of life experience. And, you know, I'm actually grateful for that. And sometimes when I work with my clients, I'll say to them, this is when I've got my coach hat on, I'll say, but where are you going to have any regrets when you're lying on your deathbed? Are you going to have any regrets? And so I think when you talk about never forget you're going to die is something that we should remember every day.
Yeah, I think it's a great philosophy. And as you said, it's a little bit dark, but that whole memento mori was the stoic sort of philosophy. Remember, you will die. And I think that lens to look through your day-to-day and make sure that you are actually living and alive and not just sort of dead at age 30 and waiting for your body to catch up with you. But it does put a great perspective on things that you think are terribly important in the moment. If you step back and look at that bigger picture and through that lens, you can start to appreciate they might not be as important. Or like Ben said, you know, the blood cuts you off in traffic, you know, getting angry about that, really, what's the point there? But I think it's been a byproduct of all of our military service having dealt with the loss of teammates and workmates, and certainly as working in the medical field and having done time in the palliative care space and working in emergency departments and hospitals, it's a great reminder that's sort of right in my face that life is fleeting and you never know when, you know, the hand of fate's going to strike, and so trying to live your best life. And then also I try and allow that to remind me to be the best husband, father I can be, you know, heaven forbid that fate should strike at some point. So I think, yeah, not without getting too morbid about it, just keeping in mind that we're not going to live forever and trying to make the most of our days and telling the people around us who we love that we love them and trying to be grateful for them, because you just never know.
Yeah. That's right. It's a good reminder. Developing a growth mindset is something I'd like to dive into a little bit, because not everyone's open to that, are they? It can be a little bit scary for some. I'm going to hand it over to whoever wants to take this one.
Well, let's hand it over to the person who discovered it first. That you might explain how you came across it then.
Sure. I'd never heard of it. And doing an MBA as I was transitioning out of the military, we did a barrage of, you know, personal reflection tests, Myers-Briggs and side tests and profiles and all that. And we did one called the Growth Mindset Test. And I'd never really heard of growth mindset, but I figured I'd nail it because, you know, it's pretty cool. I'd done all this stuff. You know, I'd been in special forces. I'd been in special operations. I was very special. I thought it'd be a blitz. And it came out I was actually relatively fixed in aspects of my mindset and got me very interested in the concept and actually became quite life-changing in terms of being instrumental in terms of
making the decision to get out of the military, to start the business with Tim initially, which was all very, I guess, risky from an ego perspective, which ultimately, when I think about that now, I laugh because I realized two things. One, that was impeding me from doing something, the stuff we're doing now, which is incredible. And two, no one cares. I was the only one who cared about my ego and my status or any of that sort of stuff. And to think that that could have threatened doing what we're doing now is, it's quite sad. I'm very thankful for coming across it.
I think the wonderful line I'd steal from Ben and Dan was a line from their dad, who encouraged them that if anyone can do it, if someone can do it, you can do it too. It absolutely epitomizes growth mindset. This relates back to locus of control, that dynamic scale Dan was talking about. Those people down at the external locus of control believe that they've just been given this hand. That's it. Mm. That I didn't get the promotion because my boss doesn't like me. I failed the exam because we didn't learn that in class. They didn't teach us that. They're not actually thinking about the opportunity that's presented through adversity. Those people with a growth mindset or demonstrating internal locus of control still have the same challenge, adversity, and problem. They still didn't get promoted, but they're asking and saying different things like this. Okay, so I didn't get the promotion, but what can I learn from the experience? What do I have to improve to make me more competitive the next time around? They still didn't pass the test, but what was it about my study habits that I need to change that will ensure in the next exam round I do a whole lot better? There's a wonderful line, and Dan or Ben might take over, but the word fear comes up a lot when you talk about fixed mindset. Some people say, oh, I don't want to do that. I've never done it before. I'm really scared of doing it. The simplest example is public speaking. When you ask people who would be comfortable standing up in front of an auditorium and doing a 3-minute talk on themselves, there's not too many hands that go up. And largely when you ask the question why, they say, I'm scared of public speaking. The word fear in English is a bit minimalist. There's a better word, actually two words in Hebrew. The first word is ashar, which is that lizard reptilian fear. Yeah. When someone pulls a knife on you and asks for your watch or your wallet, that's the fear. But the second word's more important, yira. And yira is about occupying a space that's bigger than you. Stress is stress. You still get the same physiological responses, but you're recognizing that by standing on the stage and doing that 3-minute speech, I'm going to be a little bit better than I was before. A great mate of ours, Rob Redenbach, he's done speaking on stage for a living, and he's actually a chronic introvert. You ask the question, how did Rob get to be in the top rated speakers in the country? He just reps his sense. He just does it and does it and does it until he overcomes that English word fear, or more importantly, embraces Yira. He's occupying space that's bigger than him, that's making him just incrementally a bit better than was it what it was.
Yeah, and I think I know when I'm doing public speaking, because I'm an introvert as well, and it can be difficult, is I say to myself, it's actually not about me. So even doing these podcasts, it's so not about me. It's about the others who are going to benefit. And it actually takes it away from yourself, which I find can make it a little bit easier. Fear is a big one. And can we dive a little bit more into that fear? And also, I do want to talk a little bit more about the ego too, because I believe that there can be a healthy ego, and then sometimes we can have too much ego. But I think we need a little bit of healthy ego to, so we can get out and do things and progress in life. But if we've got too much, I think that can be quite detrimental. But fear can also stop us in our tracks. And so, you know, that old saying of feel the fear and do it anyway, might have been a Brené Brown, maybe I'm stealing it too. But fear is a big one because when we're talking to our ADFs and our first responders about transitioning out of service when they've spent so long, like a lifetime, 20 odd years or whatever it is, with their uniform on, in service, they went into their purpose. That was their purpose. That was what they were passionate about. That's what they thought they were going to stay in for the rest of their lives. And when we talk to them about, well, I know I need to get out, but I'm scared as hell. So for those people that are listening that are in that situation that they know they need to get out for whatever reason, but fear may be preventing them. What guidance can you give them on that?
Yeah, look, I'll leap in there. That's a really particular area of interest of mine. And I've actually finished writing a small book around transition and looking at some of these key psychological processes at play, that loss of identity, that loss of purpose, that loss of tribe, dislocation from tribe, that social identity theory that forms us all into groups that if we're a part of, by definition, they're one of our in-groups and everything else is an out-group. And I think that the ultimate one there is the military in-group creates an out-group of civilians, and then you discharge and you are a civilian again by definition, but you still identify as military. And so I think people who are maybe approaching transition and they have that fear, I think that's a good thing because they are seeing that this is going to be a challenge. I think that the worst outcome is those, and to myself to some degree, was this person that didn't see how challenging it was going to be. I didn't anticipate that profound loss of identity, purpose, tribe coming. But look, so I think that that's a great instinct to have. But it is a negotiable period. And I think done well, understanding the psychology and the things that you are losing starts to give you the roadmap of what you need to rebuild to get back to a good version of yourself. And yeah. I think Maslow's hierarchy of needs is a good one to frame this discussion around. But just that need to, well, initially replace your basic needs. So you need to have a source of income to get food, warmth, shelter, rest, you know, put your kids through school if you've got kids, that kind of stuff. But the middle layers working towards the what Maslow called self-actualization, or being the best version of yourself you can be, they're made up of psychological things. They're things like esteem needs, their relationship, intimate relationship and work relationship needs, prestige, feelings of accomplishment, these kind of things. And so you need a purpose. You need to find another purpose. And some of that might be through work. If you're transitioning still at a working age, or if you're transitioning at retirement age, you need to have something. That might be some volunteer work. It might be going back to your old organization and using your skills to then sort of mentor the generations coming through. But you need to seek out that purpose. You need to seek out a new sense of tribe. You may not feel like wanting to do that. You'll want to gravitate back towards your old tribe because that's familiar and that's what you've known, but you need that. And to Tim's point earlier around loneliness, and you need to overcome that loneliness, that sense of isolation, because it drives a very real stress response. So just knowing these factors at play starts to give you the roadmap towards what you need to do to rebuild yourself, find a new identity, new purpose, new tribe. And it is very much a get active in your own rescue type situation. You're not going to often feel like wanting to do this, but you need to and you have to rebuild yourself into an optimized version.
Thanks, Dan.
And that feeling of disturbance or discomfort for a transitioning first responder or veteran is a good feeling. It recognizes potentially that they're feeling some level of imposter syndrome. Go one step further.
It recognizes
that there's a degree of self-awareness. Mm. And only in understanding that, maybe I won't be able to transition neatly. Maybe I don't have the knowledge, skills, and attributes to go into a next career. Well, that's kind of the start point to make your improvements. So what's missing?
Yeah.
Now do something about it in order to make a nice, neat transition. Because there's plenty of things you can do across all of those layers of resilience that we talked about before. It will set you up for success when you transition to your next big thing. The question is, will you do them?
Yes. Yeah. I am going to go back to the fear on that, because what you're talking about is that introspection too, which can be scary, going inwards and identifying, like going back to the core and identifying, you know, what am I missing? What else do I need to work on? But there's, before we talk about the ego, imposter syndrome, oh my goodness, that shows up for all of us. Like that's shown up for me, that shows up for my own clients. And through my own experience, I feel like it's something that we need to work on, we need to constantly work on and address. But do you guys have a different opinion on that?
Well, exactly the same. And I think, you know, you want to talk about ego and self-efficacy. Yeah, and I think this is exactly, you know, a beautiful segue into it. I think we do want to have that self-awareness, and we want to be aware that we're not, you know, God's gift to leadership, humanity, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really important to have that. And I'd argue about the only people who don't suffer from some level of imposter syndrome are probably those clinical narcissists who just never doubt themselves. And interestingly, they can achieve some spectacular success, but often they're not the kind of people you want to be friends with, or you'd like to lead you, or to work alongside. So we want that level of self-awareness, but we don't want to do it to the point where it's undermining ourselves. We absolutely want to have that self-efficacy. And this is where I think the semantics are probably important, you know, whether we talk about ego or we talk about self-efficacy, having confidence in yourself, being aware of, you know, that there are self-awareness areas we do need to improve. But with that same self-awareness, look at those areas where we do have strength, where we have got runs on the board, where we have demonstrated competence. Where we tend to do self-awareness, we tend to default to the negativity bias, and we just look at the stuff we need to work on. You know, that same tool needs to also be part of building up our self-efficacy. We want to be clinically looking at the stuff we're good at, the stuff we've achieved in our past. Wonderful way of doing this is to think about yourself in the third person. You know, think about the kind of advice you'd give to a friend who was in that same position. You wouldn't tell them, yeah, you're going to stuff this up. You won't get this job because you haven't got the experience and you're a chump and you always stuff up the job interview. You'd never say that when you wouldn't have any friends. You'd tell them, yeah, this is new. Sure, it's scary, but this is that good scary. This is that growth mindset. You're a scary. Mm-hmm. You've done stuff like this before. You've done scary stuff. You've prepped for this. Yeah. You know, you'd give that kind of pep talk. And so that, I think, is a nice way of maybe just rounding the edge off that negativity bias in our self-awareness and overcoming that imposter syndrome to an extent. And I think it's probably where we're at in terms of striking that fine line between a good, strong self-efficacy, self-confidence, backing ourselves, but not tipping into what I call ego, hubris, arrogance, that kind of area.
Yeah, some great advice there. What I'd like to do, I think, now is how can we best summarize this resilience? Oh, actually, no, before we summarize, there was one other thing that I'm really keen to talk about. The Dunning-Kruger effect, and it kind of flows on really well. What we were just talking about then is I used to have this up just sitting up on my desk at work to remind me. So for those people that haven't heard of this, the Dunning-Kruger effect is a kind of opposite of imposter syndrome. People who suffer from Dunning-Kruger are basically so stupid that they don't even realize that they're stupid and consequently go through life believing they're crushing it. So who's the best at talking to talk about the Dunning-Kruger?
Dan, for sure.
Yeah, there's a pretty harsh appraisal of Dunning-Kruger. Certainly it maps it to... It is a great curve, and I encourage people to look it up, the diagrammatic representation, and it maps confidence against competence. And it's got a tongue-in-cheek point that's called the peak of Mount Stupid, where you're very low in competence but high in confidence, and you're sort of set for disaster. You're working, sort of punching way outside your weight range, and things are going to go horribly wrong. And then if you fall off that, you have an event, it throws you into the valley of despair. And then ideally you climb out of that gradually along this slope of enlightenment where your confidence and your competence are more sort of related to one another and increase proportionately. But I think it is a great framework to have in mind. And certainly a question I ask myself with regards to the imposter syndrome piece is, what is my confidence underpinned by? If I feel confident in a certain area, or maybe I'm lacking confidence in a certain area and feeling a bit of imposter syndrome, I try and take that step back and say, well, what are the tangibles here that allow me to be confident? And if they're there, then you can overcome the imposter syndrome. If you find they're a bit lacking, then maybe you're drifting into Dunning-Kruger. And so from a medical perspective, there's a number of skills now that I used to do 10, 15 years ago regularly, but haven't done recently. And so my ego, if you want to use the term to relate to what Ben was talking about, humorous sort of side of ego, My ego wants to believe that I'd still be good at those skills because I could do them 15 years ago. But in reality, when I ask myself, what's my current sort of confidence underpinned by, the reality is, well, I haven't done this thing in 15 years. Could I put my hand on my heart or stand up in a court of law and say I was current and competent? And if the answer is no, then that's your sort of point of starting to say, well, either I'll stop doing these things because it's unsafe, or I'll go back and retrain and rebuild my competence in that area to underpin my confidence. But yeah, Dunning-Kruger's fantastic.
It is. Yeah, thanks for that. That was a great explanation. So just before we go on to summarise the Resilience Shield as best as we can, are there any other topics that you're really keen to touch on before we do that?
If I might just jump back quickly to the growth mindset piece, yeah. And Bill, we overlooked a critical one here to mention, Dweck and her work in the mindset space. And some of for the parents particularly, looking at the best way to praise your children. And so there's some great studies that you can look up if you're interested. But the long story short is there's studies looking at groups of kids that did certain maths problems and challenges, and they praised one group based on their outcome, so their results, and they praised one group based on their effort. And what they found is that praising around effort was by far the best way to do things to get that kid engaged and stimulated and build that growth mindset. Whereas if you praise purely based on outcome or scores or marks or results or, you know, how the footy game ended up, then it creates more of a growth of that fixed mindset, that failure versus success and sort of that's not where you want to go with your kids. So the evidence was pretty definitive there that praising around effort as opposed to outcome is the way to go to motivate kids more towards that growth mindset piece.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I just wonder whether that's something that's a good leadership tool as well. So, you know, encouraging your crew to and you know, rewarding that effort rather than always just focusing on that outcome, you know, achieving more. Yeah, I think that's really good.
Well, thing number two is that these layers aren't binary, that there is an interrelationship between the layers. And the simplest example is when you go out and do some physical fitness with a friend. Sure, you're getting the exercise value, but there's also a bit of social and certainly a bit of the mind layer wound in there. So don't think about needing to do things that are specialist to layer. In reality, you can nail a whole heap of things. And sort of dovetailing back into the conversation on happiness, there are hundreds and hundreds of research pieces of work on happiness, but it all boils down mostly to one question that someone needs to ask you to work out whether in life you're happy or not, and that is the strength of your social support network. That's kind of fascinating. We've never been in a more interconnected world, but now we're seeing 20 to 30% of the US, the UK and Australia defining as lonely. So despite all of our tools to keep us connected, we still haven't quite got that right. And often that social layer does get a little bit overlooked. We're a bit dismissive of it, but it's equally as important. Current US Surgeon General Vivek Murthy describes loneliness firstly as an epidemic, but secondly as having the physiological effect, if you're lonely, the equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. That's pretty dramatic. So don't neglect it and note its relationship into your happiness.
In fact, in a very contemporary sense, Hillary Rodham Clinton just wrote an article this week in The Atlantic citing Murdy's work, but also drawing that sort of parallel into some of the polarisation in society that lonely, ostracised people are prey for QAnon and these sort of radical groups. And our sort of the failure of things like social, you know, bowls clubs and neighbourhood networks and that sort of thing means that people don't tend to associate with people who are different than them. And so they tend to find these little sort of toxic tribes online, and we get this really stratified, polarised society. We decrease social mobility. We increase that polarisation of opinion, all of which is very negative in a societal and political sense as well as just at the individual level. So, yeah, there's a ton in that social layer. It's not just about having beers with your mates. It's a lot more to it.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And like I mentioned earlier, we are just such complex creatures. always evolving. I think I'd like all of you just to say a couple of words on to summarise the resilience shield from your perspective. So who wants to start with that one?
Yeah, look, I think just to acknowledge that resilience is, it's dynamic, it ebbs and flows. So it goes up, it goes down, it's multifactorial. And Tim gave a great summary of those layers, but it's not just one thing or a couple of things, it's all of them, but they all affect one another. So it's not just good enough to choose one or two and go with them. You've got to pay attention to all of that. But most critically, it's modifiable. So we know that you can deliberately and proactively build resilience if you know how, and Resilience Shield is designed to add to that sort of discussion around a model with an evidence base that can build resilience. We're not proclaiming it's the definitive one, but we are stating it's an evidence-based one. We've proved and published around that. But I think just one final point that I'd like to make is just when we look at resilience, the definition we favour is a better than expected outcome given the adversity faced. Mm-hmm. And so this isn't about climbing Everest, running marathons, doing these heroic, amazing things. This is always a little further based on the adversity in your life. And Sarah, you mentioned before, you know, resilience for an individual might be getting out of bed in the morning. It might be putting on their clothes. It might be a child in an abusive household that manages to get up and get themselves to school. So it's all relative to that individual. It's not about excellence in the sort of sense that we use it in the social media world. So better than expected outcome given the adversity faced, and just try and move always a little further in that direction, whatever that looks like for you.
That is absolutely brilliant. Thank you.
The other question is how to bring it to life. You know, we've probably got listeners out there thinking, okay, how do I get started? Well, at resilienceshield.com, you can undertake the resilience survey. It's been developed in conjunction with our research partner at the University of Western Australia. It's free, it's private, it's confidential, 42 questions, less than 10 minutes to undertake. And now you understand where you sit on the bell curve with resilience. You get an overall resilience score and then a score by layer. That is a perfect location to be in order to get active in your own rescue. And we're not saying make heroic changes, just identify where you have a deficit in your resilience and do little incremental things. We know that improvements aren't about the intensity. They're not about massive changes. They're about consistency. Consistency trumps intensity every single time. So what can you incorporate into your day, whack it in there as a habit, and consistently do it in order to improve those layers that are a bit diminished? That's how you bring it to life. You'll also find our Resilience Action Plan, which is an accountability tool. You can put your scores in, you can write down what your micro goals are, what tasks you're going to undertake in order to reach those goals, put it on the fridge, share it with a loved one or a friend, or even better still, have them join you in your next meaningful challenge. That's kind of how to bring it to life.
For me, the you know, we've joked throughout this podcast about stealing a bunch of stuff. There's a whole bunch of the interventions and the tools that we recommend, which probably aren't startling or revelatory for people. You know, eat better, sleep a bit better, you know, meditate, mindfulness, meaningful relationships. All of these things, a lot of people tend to think, oh, yeah, I've heard that. The trick with all of these, though, are they only work if you do them. And none of us are very good at actually committing to that. And so I'd offer that these things, the big part that we was absolutely critical to us was that everything in that book is evidence-based. It's not folksy sort of wisdom. It's neuroscience. It's stuff with repeatable and peer-reviewed data behind it. This stuff does work, but only if you do it. So try these things out. Experiment with yourself. Keep records. Think about it not as a sort of mystic, but think about it as a scientist. What would happen if I got to bed on a regular time and prioritised 8 hours sleep for a month? And, you know, make note of that. Check biometrics. Use whatever data you can to see if it's working. What would happen if I meditated a bit more? Collect anecdotal. Collect, you know, bio data as well to back that up. So think about this as an opportunity to actually institute these things in a meaningful way and actually measure the outcome.
Yeah, really great advice that you've all given. And I think, yeah, sometimes we just think we're far too busy. But journaling. You talk about journaling in the book, and it is so powerful. And meditation. I know people have said to me, I'm far too busy to meditate. And I say, well, do you have a shower every day? Because you can practice your mindfulness in the shower. Like, it is so simple. It's really, isn't it? You can, or even when you're out walking, you can practice your mindfulness. So you're right. It's about incorporating all of these tools that you guys have put in the book into your everyday life. So just some closing thoughts now. Looking back on your career, and I'd love to hear from all of you, if you could just think of one memorable moment in your career, what would that be?
The one that springs to my mind, and mileage may vary. I look back with incredible fondness on my military career. I think it just gave me so many opportunities and so many skills and such a foundation to do other things. But one of the things that just sticks in my mind when I think back in my time, that was an exercise we did, a counter-terrorist exercise in Brisbane, where we flew down the Brisbane River in Black Hawk helicopters with legs dangling out the side, and then assaulted the casino right on the river there. And it was this, it sticks in my mind as just this incredibly cool moment. I was incredibly present. It was kind of at the zenith of these sort of professional capabilities. It was a difficult iteration. It was in support of Chogan. It was a meaningful political sort of thing. But it was also this incredibly cool sort of moment in my life. And the kind of thing that no matter how rich I may get from book sales to Brazilian children. We'd probably be not, which, by the way, would not be rich. But even let's say,
get rich from that.
No, you don't. Let's say it was a success in fortune. Even in that case, no money could buy that sort of experience. And I think, extrapolating a bit from that, these cliches about being in the moment, look for that beauty, look for that amazing little cool thing in your life, big or small. Because, ultimately I started talking about this idea of happiness, but ultimately I think that's all that it is. It's those little vignettes. So that one sticks in mind. We've probably all got those little Hollywood video clips that we'd love to replay over and over again, like Ben's. My memorable moment was just after SAS selection course. We'd been put on a little coaster 22-seater with those people that had finished the course, complete under the course, and we're driving back about an hour to Swanbourne, and there was a song on the radio, What If God Was One of Us? And I really felt like I was awash with emotion. I wanted to cry on the bus, and I didn't really understand why. It was like, was it relief? Was it exhaustion? Was it a combination of all of the above? But when I think back to that moment, it was super memorable, and I think largely because I'd overcame the struggle. Whether I got selected or not was nearly irrelevant. But I had committed to training, and I'd now gone through this incredibly arduous physical and psychological course. There I was, surrounded by people who had done the same thing on that 22-seat bus. And, oh, by the way, there was a bit of mindfulness just listening to that song. That was super powerful. At the time, I was unclear what it was, but now, probably with the benefit of combing through some literature and writing some words in the book, it becomes a bit clearer.
And look, mine, I got a few. There was a couple, certainly harping back to that memento mori, that very sort of focus drawn in on how fleeting life can be and how much chance plays into that. But the one I want to talk to was one where I wasn't involved in the incident. I was actually back at base. We were deployed in Afghanistan, and I'd been out on a different mission. I'd come home back to base, and we had a team out doing a mission, and they struck a big improvised explosive device and really badly wounded one particular member of the task group. And I remember being in headquarters, pacing around, watching the drone feed, listening to the radio transmissions. And in that moment, just wishing I was there and, thinking naively and ignorantly at the time that I would have been the best person to deal with this really sort of critically injured member of the task group. But what ended up playing out was one of the medics that I worked with, who I'd had the sort of privilege of training over the years, responded to it and did with another couple of other operators. And they did a textbook job. They saved this guy's life unquestionably. They were using new capability that we'd just integrated and trained in. And what that made me realize is that my greater utility in the role that I was in was not to try and be there the whole time, but to try and do what I could in my position to run training and to try and get this skill set out there and empower others. And I found it was a real direction change for me rather than sort of push to be on every single job myself. My better utility was to stay back, try and train as many as you can. And I think also moving out of that role, I guess that left a little bit of a legacy to feel like I had done something that would endure in that capability moving past me. And that was immensely satisfying. But that was a great realization and a really sort of memorable moment from my service.
Yeah, beautiful. So capacity building while you're over there. Yeah, that's a pretty special legacy. Thank you all for sharing. If you could think about some wise words that you'd like to share with either current or former serving veterans to help them on their journey. So if there are just a couple of wise words that you'd like to share, and whether that's just one person that wants to take that known it.
Probably something from all three of us. I sit on the board of RSLWA and we come across transitioning veterans all the time. And a lot of them do have that self-doubt that they are not clear on whether they're ever going to work in a second career and be as successful as their first career. Dismiss that false doubt. There are so many transferable things, the knowledge, the skills, the attributes we talked about before that employers are seeking. And if I was to pin this up in a litmus test, we have a pathway for veterans through the RSLWA. We have more employers seeking veterans to go to their companies than we can ever find veterans. So the metric's actually on the demand side. So many people want veterans, regardless of whether you think your skills are transferable, your experience is transferable. The demand shows that there absolutely is clear transferability. So coming back to the word confidence, be confident in that. And recognize also that, sure, it might not be a perfect fit, but it's a great place to start to improve your professional skills in order to be a better version of yourself.
For me, there'd be two things. One would be, you know, we've just described these very unique sort of military moments. Don't try to compare the next chapter of your life with your previous one. It's not going to be the same. You know, there's a lot of crap in the military and the army, police, but first responders, but there's these incredibly unique, you know, beneficial aspects and amazing experiences that you can't hope to replicate. So I think a lot of people say, well, you know, when I was in uniform, it was like this or whatever. Got it. But it's not like that. You know, it's different, but no less beautiful. And the sort of second one I think that kind of ties into that is about this idea of identity and letting go of you as a soldier or a police officer or a fire or an AMPO. You know, by all means, that is a massive part of what you are at the moment, you know, what has created you. But that can't be the entirety. And, you know, that was something that I think all three of us, you know, found and I guess maybe struggled with. But, you know, the quicker you can view that as part of what brought you here rather than the entirety of who you are, and I think the better chance you've got at making that bridge.
There's a great quote that comes from Matthew McConaughey in his book Green Lights, and he says, "Black ain't near as dark once you know it's black." And I think this is fantastic in that transitioning veteran piece, because it can be a pretty dark space. And the way I interpret McConaughey's quote is, once you understand why it's a dark space, it's not nearly as dark. And so I think that period of unsettling period when you get out of military first response or any high investment role where you lose that identity and purpose, once you realize what's at play here, and it is an identity crisis, which comes from a social psychologist, Erickson, that looked at different life stages. And he used it in teenage years. You have this identity crisis, you're trying to work out who you are in the world, and then you pick an identity, you go with it and have resolution of that. But what happens, identity by definition is stable over time. And so that's how you identify. It's these constant things. And then you lose all that when you transition. A big part of your identity gets lost and it's unstable. But it's another identity crisis. You can solve it, but it is all the stuff we spoke about. But I think that black ain't near as dark once you know it's black is a good thing to use in this space. There is a way forward. And once it's about that, get active in your own rescue, understand what's at play. As Ben said, don't expect to replicate what you had in the military. And one final point, there's another thing called rosy retrospection, which is the psychologist's term for why we look back on things through rose-colored glasses. And there's all this sort of evidence to suggest that when you look back, you're only going to remember the good stuff and you'll forget about all the crap with the role. But it doesn't stop you from diminishing your current experience based on your misconception of how good your previous role was. So trying to keep a balanced appraisal of what it was, not expecting to replace it, but knowing that you need to build a new identity, find a new purpose and move forward meaningfully, I think is important. Starts to demystify that transition period.
Yeah, love it. Some really, really wise words there. And it's scary, but it's exciting at the same time. They get to reinvent themselves. And how exciting is that? Have you guys developed a Resilient Shield program or anything like that? Or is it on the cards? You talked about some tools that are on your website.
Yeah, we've got a range of different things. You know, firstly, the book is also the Resilience Journal. The journal forces you into the methodology that we talk about in the book, but you don't have to have read the book. Then we are offering keynotes, workshops, camps and retreats. They're all face-to-face, but that doesn't suit everyone. So what we have online is a resilience exponent course, which for a reasonably small outlay, you can be accredited, receiving a digital badge and a certification as a resilience exponent, a self-paced online program. We're now rolling out our resilience mentor package. In fact, Dan, Ben and myself are heading across to the UK to run some programs over there. Unfortunately, the Resilience Mentor package isn't online at the moment and it's not quite available for open enrollment, but in the fullness of time, it will be. In order to set yourself up, if you wanted to be a Resilience Mentor in your own organisation, there is a prerequisite to do the Resilience Exponents course, so you can get ahead of that by completing the Exponents course. But plenty of other things, free resources at resilientshield.com, as well as the survey, no outlay at all for the survey, and plenty of downloadable PDF tools available there as well.
You guys are doing some great stuff and you are all an absolute inspiration to others. It has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Just before we go, though, I just wanted to say a big thank you to all of you. So Dan, Ben and Tim, for your service, but also for your continued service and for giving back. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you all. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit subscribe to make sure you never miss a show. If you or someone you know could benefit from real support with their transition from service, please reach out to Sarah or Robert McComas from Tarode Solutions. We can assist you in providing employment opportunities that align to your values and purpose. Check out the services we provide at Tarode Solutions by visiting www.tarodesolutions.com.au.